The following is an excerpt from the Science Podcast. To hear the whole show, visit www.sciencemag.org and click on Science Podcast.
Finally today, David Grimm, online news editor of Science, is here to give us the rundown of some of the recent stories from our daily news site. So first up, we have a story about a nano ear. What is that?
This, Sarah, is the world's tiniest ear. And the reason they're called a nano ear is because it's actually made from a microscopic particle of gold that is trapped by a laser beam.
So what makes this little piece of gold an actual ear? How does it detect sound?
Well, the technology is based on something that's known as optical tweezers. And optical tweezers basically use a laser beam that's focused to a point with a lens to grab a hold of tiny particles and move them around. And scientists have been using optical tweezers for decades, actually, to move something as small as DNA around to get it inside of a cell. This new technology, this nano ear, takes off from that because the idea is that if you're holding something really tiny, say a microscopic particle, and instead of moving around, you just hold it there and you wait for other things to move it around, and then you measure how much it's moving. That's sort of kind of what our ears do. They detect these vibrations in the air, and as our eardrums and other parts of our ear move around, we're detecting sound. And so scientists are basically utilizing the same concept here.
So this is really more of a tool for scientists rather than a new way to produce music. What kinds of things are they looking to detect with it?
What they were able to show by creating this nano ear was they were able to detect vibrations or sounds that would be a million times fainter than we could hear, which is pretty amazing. So what produces a sound like that? Well, they're thinking about things like bacteria and viruses, which, believe it or not, actually make sounds when they wiggle around, when they invade cells, when they do other things that maybe are not so pleasant. And the idea would be perhaps someday soon we could actually listen in on these guys doing their thing, and that could potentially lead to new medical advances, could lead to new understandings about how viruses and bacteria do what they do inside of the body.
So the next story is kind of a counterintuitive result. Global warming may be related to winter cooling.
Well, sir, this story is all about why, despite the fact that we know the Earth has been warming since the late 1800s, do we continue to have cold and sometimes extremely cold winters, especially in the Northern Hemisphere? You would expect if the world is warming, then our winters should be more moderate, and yet often they aren't.
Some people anecdotally might say, yeah, last winter was really cold, this winter not so cold, but how did they measure this over time?
Well, what they do, or what they did in this new study, was they combined a lot of climate data and weather data from a variety of sources. And what they were trying to do is trying to get a lock on all the different things that contribute to things like snowfall and lower temperatures and other things that could cause a very extreme winter. And what they found was that there was sort of a Rube Goldberg type thing going on here with the weather, which is probably not surprising because weather is actually pretty complicated. And if I can sort of boil it down, what they found was that strong warming, especially in the Arctic, can cause more melting of sea ice, which you would expect. And the problem is that when you have more ice melting, you have more open water in the Arctic Ocean. That in turn leads to more evaporation, which moisturizes the entire atmosphere. And previous studies have linked warmer than average summer months to increased cloudiness. So now you have more clouds, you have more water in the atmosphere, and this in turn triggers more snowfall in places in the Northern Hemisphere, places like Siberia. And when you have more snow cover in these places, especially when you have snow cover early in the year, like in October, it has a huge effect on climate because snow cover strengthens a semi-permanent high-pressure system that's called the Siberian High. And this reinforces a climate phenomenon called the Arctic Oscillation, which in turn steers frigid air southward to mid-latitude regions throughout the winter. Now, this is all very complicated, but the net result is that when you have warmer weather, it's causing colder winter in various regions in the Northern Hemisphere.
So we've heard a lot about different cycles like El Nino. Does this also kind of add another level of cycling that we need to keep an eye on?
It adds something that we need to keep an eye on. And what the scientists say that is important that comes out of this is it really will help us refine more accurate winter weather forecasts. If we can really take account of all the various factors that come into play when we're talking about snowfall, when we're talking about temperature, then we can more accurately predict how cold, how snowy a given winter is going to be.
In our last story, we have a surprising finding on the origins of diamonds.
Well, Sarah, this story deals with a big mystery about diamonds. And the mystery is, how do diamonds get from deep within the earth, which we know is where they originate, to the earth's surface? And to make this journey, first of all, they have to have some way of migrating up. And they have to actually do this migration very quickly because there's conditions near the Earth's surface that are very violent, and they would basically melt diamonds if the diamonds hung around there for too long. So how are these diamonds getting to the surface of the Earth, and how are they getting there so fast?
So not all this study took place looking at underground phenomenon. They also did some things in the lab.
They did some stuff in the lab. And what they did basically was they tried to replicate as best they could a lot of the material that surrounds diamonds. And it turns out that diamonds are surrounded by molten rock, which can be rich in carbonates, which can give rise to carbon dioxide. And what they did in the lab was they essentially took a salt shaker and they sprinkled a silica-rich material, which is also material that can be found associated with diamonds deep within the earth, and they sprinkled that onto a puddle of molten carbonate-rich rock. This is the type of rock that can surround diamonds. And what they found was that as this mineral dissolved into the puddle over the course of about 20 minutes or so, carbon dioxide vigorously bubbled out, just like if you were to sort of open a can of soda or a bottle of champagne, you all of a sudden have these carbon dioxide bubbles that are basically fizzing all over the place. And what the researchers suspect is something very similar to that is happening deep within the earth, that carbon dioxide is fizzing out of the molten material that surrounds diamonds, not exactly like a rocket, but kind of. It's literally shooting these diamonds up from deep within the earth at speeds of up to 14 kilometers per hour, and it's allowing the diamonds to get through these very violent regions in as little as 3 to 8 hours and end up on the surface of the earth, where they become nice gems that we wear in jewelry and do other things with.
Last up, can you tell us about what was on the news site for the past week?
Right. So, Sarah, for Science Now, we've got stories about a cheaper way to make artemisinin, and this is an important component in a lot of anti-malarial drugs. Also a story about how snakes sense the heartbeat of their prey and know when to stop squeezing. For Science Insider, we've got a story about a Russian team that's drilling in Lake Vostok, which is in the center of the Antarctic continent, and how they've almost reached the lake. This is a endeavor that's been going on for a long, long time, and the researchers may be finally close to getting there. Also a story about teaching climate change in schools, how educators are finding the challenges very similar to those about teaching evolution. And finally, for Science Live, our weekly chat on the hottest topics in science, this week's chat is, surprisingly enough, about doing science in Antarctica. And our chat next week is about the science of anti-aging research, the challenges and the promises of trying to keep our aging in check. So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
Okay, thanks, David.
Thanks, Sarah.
David Grimm is the online news editor for Science. You can check out the latest news and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org, where you can also join a live chat, Science Live, on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time